Lattis and Deborah Van Fleet. The producers Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth and the Global Citizen International Digest with Mel Gertoff, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertoff, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Is Hamas popular? Anti-Semitism on the rise in Europe and here. And women should stay at home in China. Is Hamas popular? The journal Foreign Affairs reports, Arab Barometer, a research network, conducted a survey in Gaza and the West Bank days before the Israel-Hamas war broke out. The findings reveal that rather than supporting Hamas, the vast majority of Gazans have been frustrated with the armed group's ineffective governance as they endure extreme economic hardship. Most Gazans do not align themselves with Hamas's ideology either. Unlike Hamas, whose goal is to destroy the Israeli state, the majority of survey respondents favored a two-state solution with an independent Palestine and Israel existing side by side, end quote. Other polls in 2021 and 2022 showed that, on one hand, Hamas and Fatah, the party of the Palestinian Authority, were about even in public support. But the more important result may be on a question asking which party, Fatah or Hamas, is most deserving of representing the Palestinian people. 43% said neither, with 31% putting Hamas forward and 21% preferring Fatah. That result suggests disillusionment among Palestinians with the political choices available to them. These same polls found far greater support for armed struggle, another intifada, rather than for a two-state or one-state solution. That unhappy conclusion is fodder for Hamas. It evidently has every intention of attacking Israel again in the future. The Guardian reports the following, quote, senior Hamas official Ghari Hamad told Lebanese TV that his organization was determined to repeat the massacre of October 7. Hamad promised that October 7 was, quote, just the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth. He was asked if Hamas was bent on Israel's annihilation, and he replied, yes, of course. The Netanyahu government might be happy with that news, which could be used to justify its current campaign to annihilate Hamas and its continuing hold on power. But the Arab Barometer of polling concludes differently, quote, instead of stamping out sympathy for terrorism, past Israeli crackdowns that make life more difficult for ordinary Gazans have increased support for Hamas. If the current military campaign in Gaza has a similar effect on Palestinian public opinion, it will further set back the cause of long-term peace. Anti-Semitism on the rise in Europe and here. For the first time since the Holocaust, Jews in Europe are fearful. Signs of hatred abound. In every country, organizations that track hate report a major rise in anti-Semitic incidents. The New York Times reports, quote, the October 7 Hamas assault on Israel, often described as the largest single-day slaughter of Jews since Hitler's pogrom of extermination, has awakened a repressed horror in Jewish populations, now compounded by dismay at the way the world's sympathy has rapidly shifted to the Palestinians in Gaza being killed under Israeli bombardment, unquote. Germany's president said at a rally held at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin that it was, quote, intolerable that Jewish people are today once again living in fear, in our country of all places, unquote. In the week after the Hamas attack, the German federal agency that monitors anti-Semitism documented 202 episodes, a rise of 240% compared with the same period last year. Quote, we must now show what never again really means, said Chancellor Olaf Scholz. And in France, which hosts Europe's largest Jewish population, quote, France is seeing a wave of anti-Semitism not equaled since 1945, said the writer Bernard-Henri Lévy. Anti-Semitic attacks have surged since the October 7 attack, with 819 acts registered and 414 arrests made, according to France's interior minister. Europe is hardly alone when it comes to rising anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was already rising in the U.S. before the war in Israel by 36% over 2021. Since the war began, the number of reported incidents has risen further, with over 300 incidents reported. Anti-Muslim incidents are also on the rise. Women should stay at home in China. In a time long ago, China was known for promoting the idea that women hold up half the sky. Chinese women, at least in theory, if not always in fact, were considered equal to men and entitled to equal pay and equality before the law. Women's rights, children's rights too, were enshrined in the state constitution. Those rights still are there, but the party leadership has now decided that it means women should embrace traditional family values, stay home, and have more babies. Its reasoning is that China faces a demographic challenge, a shrinking and an aging population, and an economy burdened by debt. Keeping women at home, the leadership hopes, will eventually yield economic benefits. But for Chinese women, the party's message is most unwelcome. Feminism has arrived in China. Many women want careers, not babies, and want to be organized against the usual male challenges of job discrimination, sexual harassment, and efforts to disrupt women's groups like Me Too. As one scholar at Freedom House in the U.S. writes, quote, many women in China are empowered and united in their fight against the twin oppressions in China, the authoritarian government and the patriarchal society. But party officials are saying the opposite. At a recent party congress on women, the primary message was, obey the party. And the party's message is clear, stay at home. One official said, quote, it is necessary to deepen the family happiness and health campaign and contribute to supporting Chinese-style modernization through high-quality population development, unquote. Xi Jinping, addressing the Congress, said, quote, we should actively foster a new type of marriage and childbearing culture, unquote. The new type is, of course, a return to the old type. In other news, Antarctic and Greenland ice shelves in danger. New studies of the Antarctic reveal an even grimmer picture of ice loss than previously determined. It now appears that the West Antarctic ice sheet, which holds back huge glaciers, will be lost during this century, meaning that sea rise will be much faster than earlier anticipated. Sea ice melting has been occurring for some time, but loss of the ice shelves would potentially add several feet to sea rise. On the other side of the planet, northern Greenland's ice shelves, which hold back trillions of tons of ice, are in stark decline, according to new scientific research. They have lost 35% of their overall volume since 1978, equivalent to a loss of nearly 400 billion tons of floating ice that acted like the stopper of a decanter, preventing glaciers from flowing into the sea and accelerating sea level rise. Only five large shelves are left. We are heading toward an ice shelf-free northern hemisphere, one scientist said. Warm Atlantic Ocean water is one reason for the melting. If it continues, only Antarctica will have ice shelves, and as I've mentioned, that situation may not hold for many more decades. Taken together, these latest studies tell us that bringing climate change under control is essential to avoiding a collapse of both Arctic and Antarctic systems, which would threaten communities worldwide. Also related to climate change, people are moving into rather than away from flood-prone areas. In many parts of the world, including the U.S., people are recognizing the risks of global warming and choosing a place to live. They're avoiding flood-prone areas near coastlines. But in other places, especially China and Vietnam, people are actually moving into areas with a high risk of flooding as cities and towns expand outward. Jun Rentschler, a World Bank economist, says in a new study, quote, "Ideally, what we would like to see is that human settlements are avoiding these flood zones. What we find is, on average globally, it's the opposite that's happening. Rather than gradually reducing exposure to flood hazards, many countries are rapidly increasing it," unquote. What this means is that while climate change may be beyond the control of local governments, they do have control over where homes are built. They need to calculate the risks of flooding as against the benefits of more tax revenues from new construction. Violence on the West Bank. The war in Gaza has deflected attention from ongoing violence in the West Bank. The Washington Post reports, quote, "B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, says at least 7 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers since the war in Gaza began. More than 100 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by Israeli forces over the same time period, according to the United Nations. Some 500 Palestinians have been driven from their homes," unquote. Recall that President Biden had said earlier that attacks by extremist settlers, his words, amounted to pouring gasoline on fires already burning. "It has to stop," he said. "They have to be held accountable." The scale has expanded, and not just the scale, but also the severity of the attacks by settlers, said one spokesman for B'Tselem. "With the eyes of the international community on Gaza," she said, "many settlers feel as though they can act with impunity. Now it's like a Wild West." Secretary of State Blinken has met with Palestinian head Mahmoud Abbas and other leaders in the West Bank, presumably to provide assurances that the U.S. is doing all it can to stem the violence of Israeli settlers. So far, it's not working. U.S. military involvement in Israel. President Biden has made clear that the U.S. is not putting boots on the ground in Israel, but he has authorized as many as several dozen Special Forces commandos to work beside Israeli commandos in searching for hostages held by Hamas and assisting American citizens to get out of Gaza. He has also authorized U.S. drones to be used to help identify Hamas locations. A Defense Department Assistant Secretary, Christopher Mayer, said the Special Operations Forces are not assigned any combat roles in Israel, but they are talking through with their Israeli counterparts, quote, what is going to be a very complex fight going forward in Gaza. Judge for yourself whether assigned actually rules out a U.S. combat role. Expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza, an Israeli option. The Intelligence Ministry, a research arm of the Israeli government, has circulated a classified report dated October 13 that proposes, as a best option for Israel, expulsion of the entire Palestinian population from Gaza to Egypt. Gazans would be housed in a tent city and kept from returning to Israel after the war. The report is a policy recommendation, but according to a New York Times report November 5, the Israeli government is evidently taking it seriously, since it has made inquiries with Egypt about accepting a very large portion of the Gaza population for resettlement. Neither Egypt nor the U.S. or any other country is said to support the idea, but the fact that such a step is even being considered within the Israeli government is disturbing. First, because the Israeli Defense Forces have already ordered nearly half the Gaza population to evacuate to the south. Second, because the forcible removal of a population is a war crime. And third, because all the Palestinians want is to return to their homes. Israel might say the deportation is just until the war ends, but such steps have a way of becoming permanent, which is the Palestinians' greatest fear. This research paper appears at an ominous time. The Gazan population in the south is not entirely able to escape the bombing that is taking place mainly in the north. BBC has reported on specific airstrikes in southern Gaza that are very near to areas the population has been directed to go for safety. Also ominous is the comment by Prime Minister Netanyahu that Israel might have to exercise direct rule over Gaza after the war for an indefinite period, a decision that would surely drive many Gazans to abandon hope of returning home. The White House issued a statement November 7 that said, quote, "Reoccupation of Gaza by Israeli forces is not good for Israel or the Israeli people." Finally, attacks on universities worldwide are increasing. Scholars at Risk, an organization that tracks government attacks on universities, faculty, and students worldwide, reports 409 such attacks in 66 countries over the past year. Its annual report for 2023, called Free to Think, focuses mainly on authoritarian regimes such as Iran, China, and Myanmar, but also comments on repressive policies in democratic governments, including the U.S. Among the report's main stories are Iran's crackdown on university students and faculty following the popular protests in September 2022 in support of the student who was killed after refusing to wear the hijab, the Taliban's ban on women taking university entrance exams, the Myanmar military's arrests and torture of students, China's school surveillance system, and Hungary's pressure on professors for conformity in their thinking. The U.S. is cited for legislation in various states that limit teaching and research on racial and gender diversity. Scholars at Risk says that 40 bills were introduced in 22 states to limit or restrict spending on diversity, equity, and inclusion programming at public colleges. In addition, academic exchange and scientific collaboration between American and Chinese scholars may be diminished because of ongoing scrutiny of ties between the two countries. Well, that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks very much for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's fall here in Portland, traditionally the beginning of the holiday season, and this year we have even one more reason to celebrate. It's the 100th birthday of Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, and certainly the first to turn 100. Dating back to 1924, PYP kicks off its historic season this Saturday, November 11th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, titled This Midnight Hour, features works by Anna Klein, Camille Saint-Saëns, and Antonin Dvorak, and according to the concert notes, quote, takes listeners on a journey through the darkest hour into the uplifting embrace of daybreak. I think that journey, driven by the healing power of great music, is one we all can use about now. To help celebrate PYP's 100th season and preview the opening concert, we're fortunate to have David Hattner, PYP's musical director, and Nolan Tu, winner of PYP's 2023 Piano Concerto competition. That concert on Saturday, the 100th season opener, is titled This Midnight Hour, and it gets its name from the Anna Klein piece featured in the program. How'd you go about selecting the pieces to fit that theme? I think you usually start with the Piano Concerto competition winner's piece, which in this case is the Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2.
Yeah, we've often put the Piano Concerto winner, which we do every second year, on the opening concert. And I needed something that would contrast with the rather lighthearted and frothy nature of that Saint-Saëns concerto. It's not quite what you would call one of the more intellectual of the piano concertos. It's for fun and also to really delight the audience. And another thing that's delighted audiences for many, many years are pieces that have some terror in them. So while the Saint-Saëns is like a frothy concoction, Anna Klein's This Midnight Hour is a little like A Night on Bald Mountain from Mussorgsky. It's haunted. It's got sounds in it that are, some of them are dissonant, but mostly they're ominous. And then at the end, it transforms and becomes more like a hymn or a chorale, similar to what Night on Bald Mountain does. And so I thought, since audiences have always enjoyed these pieces that sound like they come from a scary movie or actually come from a movie soundtrack, that they would really enjoy This Midnight Hour. And the invited guests we've had visit rehearsals of it were struck by its brilliant orchestration and just the power of its ideas. So I think it turned out to be a pretty good choice, but I just discovered it, like many people do on YouTube, by searching for Anna Klein, who's a well-known composer whose music is widely performed. And this piece really struck me as, like, that's something you could open a season with.
Now, it's described as a tone poem, And I'm quoting here, it suggests the shadowy, nocturnal world of film noir. Mm-hmm. Klein herself said it's inspired by two poems, Harmonie du Soir by Charles Baudelaire, and a very short poem that I could read the translation. It's called La Musica by Juan Ramon Jimenez. Robert Bly did the translation. It goes, music, a naked woman running mad through the pure night, which is such great imagery. How much background on a piece do you usually give the musicians when preparing the performance? Did you have them read the poems in this case?
I decided not to read the naked running through the night poem to the orchestra.
Based on their age? Or
no, I think sometimes the music really just speaks for itself. And this is one of those cases where they can sense very easily what's going on in this piece, that it's not... you know, it's not the morning mood from Peer Gynt, you know, with the twittering birds. It's a little darker at night time. And so I haven't read the poems or talked about it in this case. Sometimes I will do that. But they're a curious bunch, and they've probably learned most of what they need to know from practicing the notes and listening to each other's parts in rehearsal.
Nolan, you're the soloist on Saint-Saëns' Piano Concerto No. 2, which you played when you won PYP's 2023 Piano Concerto Competition. What inspires you about this piece as a musician?
So what basically inspired me to play the Saint-Saëns' Piano Concerto for this competition was because that upon listening to many of the different piano concertos out there, the Saint-Saëns' Piano Concerto No. 2 has a vast amount of melodies throughout the piece, and throughout the second movement, there's a bunch of playful and more beautiful melodies, and I feel like I really enjoyed it a lot. And aside from that, with the themes that show up in the first and third movements, I believe that they like resonate with me a lot because of the emotional journey. And so yeah, I'm excited to be able to express that to the audience soon.
Now, when did you start playing piano, and what attracted you to the instrument? I read that you began music training at age 6 and then started studying the piano at age 7, mm-hmm. So very early.
Yeah. So my parents, my mom and dad, listened to a lot of classical music CDs when I was younger. So I've been around music a lot. And my sister also started playing piano when she was young. So it was before I turned 7. So I've been listening to a bunch of classical music and also piano. So when I was a kid and I heard my sister playing piano, I was really like excited. And I also wanted to be able to play the piano. So yeah.
If she could do it, I can, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was 7, I started learning the piano, and yeah.
You're now a high school senior, so you've been playing for quite a few years, even though you're still very young. And in addition to your academic and your piano studies, you're also on the school swim team?
Yeah.
Do you see a connection between playing piano and competitive swimming, maybe in terms of the discipline required?
For the discipline, there is a pretty big amount of connection between any type of instrument you want to play or any field that you're interested in doing, because throughout my experience, if you want to get better or improve on whatever you do, there's a lot of focus you have to put into it and a lot of hard work. So for piano, you would practice a lot, put a lot of effort into that. And for swimming, you would also have to do the same, because like if I would want to improve in, let's say, just any stroke in general, I would have to work on that a lot, maybe talk to the coach, which also kind of applies with piano, with your teacher and stuff.
What are your plans for continuing your studies after you graduate high school? Are you considering a career in music?
So for the career in music, I'm considering, I'm not really sure as of now, but I know for sure that after I graduate high school, I still want to continue doing music. So apart from music, I'm also interested in either any science or engineering related field. So I'll have to be able to balance those two. And then when I have more experience with both of them, I guess the career would start panning out in my head.
So still kind of early, but there's a lot of ways you can go. You're very talented in several areas, but probably not a competitive swimmer professionally. that might be tough.
Probably not.
Well, David, we'll be back previewing the rest of PYP's 100th season before each concert through May 2024. But I just want to mention the very special final concert, which takes place May 31st. That will feature the very first piece performed by PYP, Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. That's very appropriate.
Yes, I've never done it. All of my predecessors on one anniversary or another did the Unfinished. So I thought it would be appropriate to have Hugh Edwards conduct it. And in fact, he's going to conduct the entire first half of the 100th anniversary concert because he's also due to conduct the Academic Festival Overture on December 26th and on May 31st. And he had requested to do some English music and suggested Benjamin Britten's 4C interludes from Peter Grimes, which is tremendous work. And I'm just thrilled that they'll have the opportunity to play these works with someone who knows them so deeply and is such an important historic figure in the history of the organization.
And also Thomas Lauderdale of Pink Martini will be there, and Hunter Nowak. They'll be performing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, so that's quite a program.
Yes, I'm excited about that. Thomas played the Rhapsody in Blue with the orchestra and Mayan Chen probably about 20 years ago. And he and Hunter and I performed their special version of the Rhapsody in Blue for four hands and orchestra with the Oregon Symphony in 2021, I believe it was, as part of the Pink Martini Valentine's performances that year. And we just had such a great time doing it. And they also really would like an opportunity to record it. And it's hard for them to get the opportunity to record it with a professional orchestra because of all the union regulations. So we're going to do a bunch of things with this performance. But the most important thing is that we'll be celebrating the 100th anniversary. Thomas Lauderdale has been a big fan of the Portland Youth Philharmonic since he was a student at Grant High School and had many friends in the orchestra and wrote articles about it for one of the local newspapers. And of course, Pink Martini has performed with the Oregon Symphony on, I believe, five separate New Year's Eves during my time here. So we've worked together quite a bit, and we admire each other's work very much.
Now, talking about that legacy, that Thomas Lauderdale, I mean, he's looking just at a small part of it. You're going back to the turn of the century, pretty much. A new exhibit is celebrating your centennial. It opened at the Oregon Historical Society just last week. It's called Sagebrush to Stumptown, Portland Youth Philharmonic's Astonishing First Century, and it runs through February 4th. I think you were there at the opening ceremonies last week. Mm-hmm. What can listeners expect to see when we come to visit?
A wonderful photograph. The young musicians of the orchestra have made great photographic subjects, not surprisingly, for all of that time. And photographs of the conductors, of course, and artifacts from programs to record jackets to tour paraphernalia, some artwork, and an audio loop of some historic moments from the orchestra's history on the radio, and some video projections as well of each of the conductors and some alumni interviews and so forth. So it's really, it's not an exhibit that will take tons and tons of time to go through, but it's been very nicely curated by Kristen Knapp, our alumni relations coordinator. And she spent a lot of time going through an enormous number of possibilities that could have been displayed, and I think chose really wisely, along with some expert advisors and the curators from the Historical Society, this lovely exhibit, which features an extraordinary blown-up version of the Sagebrush Orchestra, which Mary Dodge founded in Harney County in the second decade of the 20th century. And in 1916, they took a picture on a 4th of July float that was built for them, and it's a very fun picture that many people have seen because of the documentary that Oregon Public Broadcasting did about the Sagebrush Orchestra about a dozen years ago. So I think people should stop by and see it. It won't take up your whole day. And
what a great opportunity to go back in time.
Yeah, you'll learn a little more about this really remarkable organization that's still going.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us today and for taking time out during a very busy week. Not only the opening concert, but you mentioned you're also down in Corvallis. You'll be conducting the orchestra there, too. I just want to wish PYP a very happy 100th and many more years to come. We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and Nolan Tu, winner of PYP's 2023 Piano Concerto Competition. David will be conducting the opening concert for PYP's historic 100th season with Nolan as soloist on Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2 this Saturday, November 11th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets, if you like, at portlandyouthphil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Denver.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio just wrapped up our annual fall membership drive. Support from listeners like you helped us reach our goal, gain new members, and prepared us to bring you more organic, homegrown, fresh-off-the-vine community radio. Thanks to all those who donated during this drive, and thanks to those who listened in. Stay tuned for more.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the "I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers" and all that kind of